that on. Okay, so we're going to start with a dihybrid cross, and we're going to consider what would you get in the first filial generation, the F1, if these are the parents, what would be the F1, what would be the F2? Now, the procedure is exactly the same as we did in a monohybrid cross. You figure out the gametes of each parent, you figure out the zygotes, etc. So, if this individual makes gametes, what's going to end up in the gamete? We're assuming that A's are alleles of one gene and B's are allele of another. So we have to have an allele of A and an allele of B. Now, if you think you could have two A's or two B's, then you better think again. You better go home and convince yourself that you can't. Now, from the other one, we're going to get little AB, no matter what. So if these are the parents, when we put the gametes together to get zygotes, we're going to get a double heterozygote. But what is going to happen next is going to depend where gene A with alleles A and A and where gene B is located. And what we're going to do first is we're going to assume that alleles big A and little a are alleles of one gene on one chromosome, on one pair of homologs, and alleles big B and little b are alleles of another gene that's on a different pair of homologs. So you want to take out your handout for today, and you want to look at 22b. You want to look at the right-hand case, because what we want to know is, what are the gametes? So how do you get gametes? You put your genes on chromosomes, and you take the chromosomes through meiosis. We didn't have to do that the first time because it was too obvious. But what about the second time? So we're assuming that we're starting out with one pair of chromosomes that has the A's. I'm going to draw, as on your handout, one homolog straight and one wiggly. And one pair of homologs that has the B's. And to make life simple, I've put the capital letter allele on the straight homolog, on the straight member of the pair, and the lowercase allele on the wiggly. Now, of course, each of these lines represents a double-stranded DNA molecule, but we're just drawing it one line to keep it simple. Now, what will happen if this cell goes through meiosis and it produces gametes? What we want to know is how many kinds and in what proportions. So, as it shows on your handout, we know the first thing you have to do is you have to double the DNA. So that's the absolutely first thing. And so we're going to double the DNA, like so. And now we can actually do meiosis. So when it's time for meiosis, we know that you have to line the homologs up in pairs on the metaphase plate. So we're going to assume the metaphase plate is in the middle of the cell through the equator. So we're going to line up, remember this is meiosis, so we're going to line up pairs. So let's say we line up the big chromosome. How are we going to line up the small chromosome? Wiggly on top or straight on top? Well, it could be either way. We're assuming the straights, say, came from one parent, let's say maternal, and the wigglies from the other parent, paternal. Well, we could have the straights together, or we could have it the other way. Now, each pair of chromosomes lines up at meiosis, and it's 50-50 who's on the top, who's on the bottom. So that means that either of these setups is equally likely. Now, why does it make any difference? Let's see. At first division, what is supposed to happen? We're supposed to separate homologs. So in the left case, we're going to separate the two straight homologs from the two wigglies. But in the other case, on the right, we're going to do a mix and match them. So the straight big is going to go with the wiggly small, and the wiggly big is going to go with the straight small. Now, that makes a difference because the straights have the uppercase alleles and the wigglies have the other allele. So when we actually go through second division and make gametes, make haploids, it's going to make a difference. Because from this, we're going to get, from the top cell, we're going to get cells that have a big straight and a short straight. How many of these are we going to get? We're going to get two because one cell gets one chromatid of each. One cell gets one of each. So I'm just going to write times two. And then we're going to get two cells that have all wiggly. Now, how does that go in the A and B department? Remember, the uppercase alleles are on the straight chromosomes. So these are going to be capital A, capital B. And these are going to be little a, little b. But now, what about the other half? That's what's going to happen half the time. Half the time, half of our gametes are going to be capital AB, and half of our gametes are going to be little AB. But half of the time overall, I'm going to get this 50-50 mix. But half the time, gametogenesis is going to take the other path, and what am I going to get this time? Two cells are going to get a big straight and a little wiggly. And two cells are going to get a big wiggly and a little straight. Now, if we put our A's and B's on, this is a capital, lowercase, lowercase, capital. So this time, half the gametes are big A, little b, and half the gametes are little a, big b. So having gone through this whole rigmarole, if you have many, many meiosis, what are you going to end up with? Half the time, meiosis goes this way. Half the time, meiosis goes that way. So what are you going to end up with? How many kinds of gametes? Four, because we're going to get these two and those two. So we're going to get four kinds of gametes. What proportions? Are you more likely to get one or the other? No, it's even Steven. So we're going to get all four kinds in equal proportions. That's the point of this. All right. So that got me the gametes. But now how do I get zygotes? What's the standard method? Now you want to turn your hand out over. So we just figured out that your gametes are 1/4 each, capital AB, capital A little b, little a capital B, and little a little b. So each parent is going to give us that. This is the F1. We have the gametes of the F1. How do we get the gametes of... We now want to get the F2. So we want to know if one parent kicks in these four kinds of gametes in equal proportion and the other parent kicks in the same, what do we get? So now you look at the top of your handout and you see what the obvious thing to do is. The obvious thing to do is to make a big fat square. And you put the four kinds of gametes... One parent, four kinds of gametes of the other parent, and you fill it in. This is a pain. You can do it this way. And this way, however, is quite tedious, and it's very easy to make a mistake. So you really, well, you could do it that way. But suppose someone gave you a cross with four genes. You think about the number of gametes, the size of the square, clearly this would not work. So, just in case something like that should happen to you, you really want to know, how do you do it without making the huge square? And the next panel shows you how to do it. In order to get this far, we made an important assumption. We made an assumption that the chromosomes carrying the A's line up independently of the chromosomes carrying the B's. So what the A's do doesn't affect the B's, and what the B's do doesn't affect the A's. So we can pretend that we did it one at a time. So the first thing we can consider is, suppose we had done the A part. This was our cross. If we go back to here, just consider if we just did the A part, what gametes, what zygotes. So we know how to do that from last time. if you just did this kind of cross, what would happen? So it's written out in your handout. We know that if you go through meiosis, we went through it last time, you're going to get half big A gametes and half little a. So what would the zygotes be? How do you do it? If you don't remember, you make a little square. But this is a nice, small, convenient square. Big A, little a, gametes from one parent. Big A, little a from the other parent. What can you get? You fill it in. And you either fill it in or you remember that you're going to get homozygous big A to heterozygous to homozygous little a in a ratio of 1 to 2 to 1 or 1 quarter, 1 half, 1 quarter, as written out on your handout. Okay, but what about the B's? Suppose I had just done the B part. How would that come out? Well, I could do the same thing. I know that each of these parents gives me two kinds of gametes, half big B, half little b. So I could make a little square with the B's. I could fill it in. And I would realize that for the B's, the way it's going to come out, it's homozygous big B to heterozygous little b, homozygous little b of, again, 1 to 2 to 1, or 1 quarter, 1 half. All right. But the A's and the B's are independent of each other. So if I know the chance of how the A's will come out, and I know the chance of how the B's will come out, I can put it together. For example, what is the chance of getting big A, big A, big B, big B? Well, what's the chance of getting big A, big A? 1/4. What's the chance of getting big B, big B? 1/4. So what's the chance of getting both? It's actually, what is the chance, if you know the chance of something, and you know the chance of something else, what is the chance they will both happen? That you get something and something. What do? You multiply. So it's going to be 1/4 times 1/4, or 1/16. Now, how do you handle the whole thing? Notice, when I wanted to get one possibility, I didn't have to fill in the whole thing, see how often that one appears. It would be once. And do the whole thing. I could pick this one out and do it all by itself. But suppose I wanted to know all the possible combinations. This is written on the bottom. How do you keep track of them all? By filling this in, I would see, it would be 16 squares, I would see how many of them have different genotypes, how many are the same. But the other way to do it is by the branch method, which is shown on the bottom here. We know for the A's all together, how many different A combination genotypes can you get? 3. So I can get big A, big A, big A, little a, and little a, little a. What about B? How many B combinations? Same old 3. So any of these 3 can go with any of the other 3. So I can keep track of it that way, that this A combination can go with any of the 3 B combinations. Similarly, this A combination can go with any of the 3 B combinations. And this A combination genotype can go with any of the others. Now, this tells me right off how many possible genotypes I can get out of this cross. How many?
16.
Is it 16 or 9? It's 9 different ones. Because if you filled in the box in the 16, there would be 16 squares, but some of the same genotypes would appear twice or more. So this says of the 16 possible combinations, there are only 9 unique ones. And you don't have to fill that in and count. So there are 9 unique possibilities, and we know now how to calculate the proportions of each one. For example, we did for big A, big A, big B, big B. You figure out what's the probability of big A, big A, 1/4. You figure out the probability of big B, big B, 1/4, and you multiply them together. So the chance of big A, big A, big B, big B is 1/2, 1/4 times 1/4, or 1/16. Now, just to be sure we've got it, what's the chance of double heterozygote? That's this one, right? So what's the chance of big A, little a? 1/2. What's the chance of big B, little b? 1/2. So this tells me that 1/4 will be double heterozygous. And if I wanted to, I could fill it all in. But I'm not going to bother. Because what have I got here? Genotype or phenotype? Genotype, and I'm really interested in phenotype. So now what I want to consider is, what are the phenotypes? And I'm going to start with what is really sort of the simplest possible case. And that's actually sort of diagrammed on your handout. Let's assume that allele capital A codes for working enzyme, and little a codes for none. This is written in the little box on the bottom. And that similarly, big B, so we'll call it enzyme A, big B gives you enzyme B, little b gives you none. And to keep it simple, enzyme A is in charge of catalyzing X to Y, and enzyme B catalyzes K to Z. Now, the point of this is that each enzyme has a job which is independent of each other enzyme, and we're going to assume complete dominance. Because in the examples which we've implied by using big A and little a, we're assuming that as long as you have some enzyme A, you can do X to Y. As long as you have some enzyme B, you can do K to Z. Now, that means who can do X to Y? Genotype-wise. Can big A, big A? Can big A, little a? Can little a, little a? No. So, we're saying that big A blank can do the A job. And little a, little a can't. So, when it comes to phenotypes with respect to A, there's only 2. You can do the A job or you can't. But what's with the B job? It's the same? Same idea. If you got a big B, you can do the big B, you can do the B job. If you don't, you can't. So these are the possibilities by the branch method. If you're big A and anything, if you have one big A and one big B, doesn't matter what goes in the blank, you can do both jobs. You'll have one phenotype. If you're big A but little b, you can do the A job but not the B job. If you're little a, big B, you can do the B job but not the A. And if you're little a, little b, can't do either. Now, just as we figured out this way, that there were 9 genotypes, how many phenotypes are there? Let's take a vote. 2, 3, 4, more than 4. So we have a few people who think there's 3 or more than 4, but most people think there are 4. Where did the 4 come from? Somebody tell me. Where did 4 come from?
You can do both, neither, or either A or B.
You see his argument? Either you can carry out both conversions, this conversion, that conversion, or no conversion. Those are the 4 phenotypes. Now, it doesn't have to be that way, but this is the simplest case. So we've reduced our 9 genotypes to 4 phenotypes by assuming complete dominance, and each enzyme has an independent job. What are the proportions? Well, what proportion are going to be big A, 1? Well, what's big A blank mean? It means you're big A, or big A, little a, right? Now, we know if we want to figure out the chance of something or other and something, we multiply. If you want to figure out the chance of something or something, you add. The only catch is they have to be alternatives. You can't be both of these at the same time. You can only be one or the other. If you have things that are alternatives, the chance of being one or the other means you just add. Well, if you want to know the chance they are both, you multiply. So, what's the chance of being big A, big A? 1/4. What's the chance of big A, little a? Is a half. So what's the chance of being one or the other? Is 3/4. So that's all you have to know about probability to do genetics. You have to know that either the and means multiply and or means add. That's about it. Now, if you know more, some things are easier, but that's all you have to know. So we know what's the proportion of A, of able to do the A job. 3/4 of the total. What's the chance among Bs of being able to do the B job? 3/4. So the chance of being big A blank big B is 3/4 × 3/4 or 9/16. Now, what's the chance of being able to do the A job but not the B? That's the chance of this genotype times the chance of this genotype, which is 3/4 × 1/4 or 3/16. 3/16. Who can't do anything? Little a, little a, little b. Little b, which is what proportion? It's 1/4 × 1/4 or 1/16. Now, there is the familiar ratio of 9 to 3 to 3 to 1. This is where it comes from. If all these conditions are met, complete dominance, independent inheritance, independent action of enzymes, then you will get 9 to 3 to 3 to 1 ratios in the F2 offspring of 4 phenotypes. Does this mean if you have 16 offspring, one of them will be little a, little a, little b, little b? No, it does not. It means that the probability of any individual offspring being little a, little b, little b is 1 in 16. And if you have lots and lots and lots of offspring, 1/16 of them will be little a, little b, little b. Now, this is the simplest case, and now I want to consider some not so simple ones. But before I do that, let me ask if there are any questions.
When you get to the genotype part down there, how would you approach that if you have 3 different chromosomes?
Oh, that's a very good question. What would you do if you were looking at, say, gene A on one chromosome, and gene B on another chromosome, and gene D on another chromosome? Well, each one would be independent. So, if I had a D, each of these could go with 3 more, etc. So, let's pick, there's actually an example in your notes of how you extend this. It's good you reminded me. Let's suppose that somebody who shall remain nameless asks you on an exam, if you have this cross, little a, homozygous big B, little c, big B, little d, what is the chance of getting a quadruple heterozygote? Now, you could do this by the square method. You could figure out all the gametes of this one, all the gametes of that one, and make an enormous square and be here till next Tuesday. But alternatively, you could say if each of these genes is on a different chromosome, then each gene acts independently. Each pair of homologs carrying each pair of alleles acts independently of all the others. So we can figure out the result for the A's. We can figure out the result for the B's, the C's, and the D's, and just multiply it out. So what is the chance of getting a heterozygote from this, from the A part? What's the chance of that? Well, if you're not sure, how many gametes from this one? How many kinds?
Two.
Two. How many kinds of gametes from this one?
One.
Only one. So out of this cross, what am I going to get? Half heterozygote, half homozygous recessive. So the chance of getting heterozygous big A little A is 1/2. Now, what's the chance of getting, actually this one is also 1/2, but what about the C's? What's the chance of getting a heterozygote? Is actually 1, because all you can get is a heterozygote from little c, big C, big C. And from the D's, what's the chance of a heterozygote? This is your standard heterozygote cross heterozygote, and it's 1/2. And you can figure that one out too. So the answer is 1/2 times 1/2 times 1 times 1/2 is the chance of getting a quadruple heterozygote. Okay, any more questions before we go on? Yeah.
Can you work backwards? In other words, if you get the 9:3:3:1 ratio, how safe is it to assume that they're not linked?
Okay, so his question is, can you do this backwards? And the answer is yes. That you can start with known conditions about whether the genes are linked or not and how their products work. In other words, what you know about inheritance and metabolism, and predict ratios. But you can also do it backwards. From ratios, you can predict what's the state of the genes. But notice here, it's not just the gene A and B are on different chromosomes, that is that they're unlinked, but we had to make other assumptions as well. That enzyme A, for example, and enzyme B were in charge of totally different reactions, etc. When you get these kinds of ratios, then you would say that gene A and gene B were standard Mendelian genes. They were acting in the standard simple way. Now let's try and look at some more, you might say, interesting cases. We have been assuming all along that the relationship is one gene, one trait. Therefore, two genes, two traits, or three genes, three traits. That it is all one-to-one. This is not always so. You can have one gene which controls more than one trait. Classic example of this is the gene for the beta chain of hemoglobin. Mutations in that gene control whether you have sickle cell disease or not. In other words, they control the shape of your red blood cells. But they also control resistance to malaria. And these are really two entirely different traits which happen to be related and are due to effects of the same gene. Now, it can work. This is called pleiotropy. When you get multiple effects from changes in a single gene. Now, it can work the other way around, too. Here was one gene, two traits. It can work two genes, one trait. And I want to do a couple examples of that, where gene 1 and gene 2 together affect the same trait. Now, this is actually extremely common. Consider most biochemical pathways. What does it take to synthesize the end product? It doesn't take the product of one gene. It takes the product of many genes making all the necessary enzymes to get to the end product. Any complex trait is like this. Anything really worth thinking about, like height, smarts, musical ability, any of those things undoubtedly are not determined by the effects of a single gene, but by many different genes acting in concert. So I want to do a couple examples of how different, if you have multiple genes affecting the same trait, what that will do to your pattern of inheritance. So first, let me make some space here. I'll leave that for now, I think. going to leave this part is going to be the same, that we have basically four abilities, we would say. We have four classes of offspring. Those who can do both jobs, one job, the other job, neither job. But one possibility is that those two jobs are related. And a classic example of that is, suppose that you have some gene. You have another gene. Each of them makes an enzyme. But this time, I should say instead, each of them makes a peptide. So these are subunits or individual peptides which combine to make one enzyme. And that enzyme converts X to Z. Now, this is different from the previous case. In the previous case, the product of gene A did one thing, and the product of gene AB did something else. But now the products of gene A and B are both needed to get one job done. How is this going to affect our outcome? It's customary to define the phenotypes here as either you can make Z or you can't. Or you could look at it the other way. Either you can break down X or you can't. So one way to look at it is either you're Z plus or Z minus. Z plus can make Z, Z minus can't. There's really only two phenotypes here, not four. Because either you can make Z or you can't. But what proportions, you're not going to get four phenotypes, you're only going to get two. But what are the proportions going to be? If you started to do the same dihybrid cross, we know that these are the proportions you'd get in 9 to 3 to 1. But now, what proportion of these can our Z plus can get the job done? Which ones? Maybe I should put in the 16th. I think that's easier to understand. What proportion are going to be Z plus phenotype? Only the 9/16. Everybody else is going to be Z minus. It doesn't matter if you don't have subunit A or subunit B or either one. As long as you don't have both of them, you're in the same boat and you're Z minus. So the ratios, instead of being 9 to 3 to 3 to 1, it's going to be 9 to 7. Or 9/16 and 7/16. Now let's consider another possibility. Instead of the two genes coding for two subunits and the enzyme, let's assume they code for two different enzymes that catalyze two steps in the same pathway. So we get enzyme A, enzyme B, and now we do X to Y to Z. These pictures, by the way, are in your notes. Well, suppose Y is just a precursor. Y has no use whatsoever except to make Z. So in that case, how many phenotypes are there here? The only issue is, can you make Z or not? Same as before. In fact, this reduces to the previous case. If Y has no use whatsoever except to make Z, then again, only somebody with a capital A and a capital B is going to be Z plus, and everybody else is going to be Z minus. So in this issue also, situation also, you're going to end up with 9 to 7 can do it versus can't. But a more interesting case is then Y is good for something. A classic example of this is when co-color in certain animals, where if you have X, you're white, and if you have Z, you're black. But if you have Y and not Z, you're brown. Now, if all we're considering is can you make Z or not, then there's two possibilities. You're white or you're black, 9 to 7. Or 7 to 9. But if we're considering all three, what we're saying is here we have a case where there are three possible phenotypes. If you don't get anywhere, you're white. If you can do the first step, but not the second, you're brown. If you can do both steps, you're black. So now we're up to three phenotypes. Or you could say, if you need Y and you need Z, either you can make Y, you can make Z, or you can make both. What proportions will these occur in? If you have two heterozygotes, you do a dihybrid cross, and you look at their offspring, what proportion are going to be black? They come back to here. Who's black? Just this one. You can go all the way. Who's brown? This one's brown. Because he can get the first step, but not the second. Who's white? Everybody else. It doesn't matter. As long as A is blocked, who cares about B? Even if you could convert Y to Z, if you haven't got any Y, it doesn't do you any good. So as long as the first step is blocked, the state of the second is not known. This is called epistasis. And people say that gene A is epistatic to B. What they really mean is that the little a genotype blocks out the state of the B. You don't know what B is. Once you're little a, that's it. Now, sometimes people confuse epistasis and dominance. Both of these are cases where the effects of one allele or genotype or something overrides another one. But they're quite different. When you're talking about dominance, you're talking about the effects of big A overriding the effects of little a. When you're talking about the effects of epistasis, you're talking about the effects of the state of gene A overriding gene B. Now, this is not the same thing. Because with dominance, you're talking about one allele of the gene versus another allele of the same gene. With epistasis, you're talking about the genotype of one gene overriding the genotype of another gene. So they're not the same. Now, we've done a couple of examples here. But there are many, many examples of different relationships between genes, proteins, and pathways. For each combination, you get a different pattern of inheritance or different ratios. Now, the way we've done it here is to say, if we know what proteins the genes make and we know what those proteins do, we can predict the pattern of inheritance. And there are problems in the problem book. We have to do that for cases that are like this and cases that are different. For example, one of the genes might be on the X. One of you might have incomplete dominance. There's all kinds of other possibilities. Also, however, it's often done the other way, as in the question that you asked. Sometimes from the proportions or the pattern of inheritance, you reason backwards and you calculate, you figure out how do those genes' products work in metabolism. So you have problems in the problem book in both directions, from ratios back to genes and enzymes and from genes and enzymes to ratios. And you get a chance to try both. Now, in all of the cases we considered so far, we followed gene A, we followed gene B, but gene A was on one chromosome, the alleles of gene A were on one pair of homologs, and gene B was on a different chromosome. The alleles of gene B were on a different pair of homologs. And I want to consider what happens if gene A and B are on the same chromosome. But before I do that, are there any questions? Yeah.
So when we talk about these ratios and offsprings, how does that relate to proportions in the overall population?
How does this relate to proportions in the overall population? Well, we're assuming here that you're crossing double heterozygote with a double heterozygote. Now, the proportion of heterozygotes in the population isn't necessarily 100%. What we're going to discuss a little bit next time is, if you look at it not from the end point of view of individuals, but the point of view of the population. Because how many big A, little A's you're going to have is going to depend on the overall proportion everywhere of big A's and little A's. If there are very few little A's total, then most people will be big A. And most crosses will not be like this. Any other questions? Okay. So now I want to go back and consider the possibility that the A's are on one chromosome and the B's are on the same one. And to keep this straight, we're going to try and distinguish the genes and the alleles. So we're going to talk about gene alpha that has alleles big A, little A, and gene beta that has alleles big B and little B. And to look at this, we want to go back to the other side of your handout again. And we want to consider the consequences if A and B, if genes alpha and beta are on the same chromosome. So that means that the starting parents, what's going to be the pattern of inheritance? We do everything the same way. You start with your parents, you make gametes, you make zygotes, you see what happens. So what if the parents look like this? We now have only one pair of homologs to deal with, but both gene alpha and gene beta are on the same pair of homologs. So before we can do anything, of course, same thing happens. We have to double the DNA. So that means, of course, when we go through meiosis, we're going to get four products. But the question is, what are they going to be this time? Now, one possibility, we know what happens at first division. At first division, we separate homologs, and at second division, we separate sister chromatids. Now, suppose when we get to this stage, we start meiosis, there is no crossing over involving this pair of chromosomes. There is no crossing over in between genes alpha and beta. In that case, where are the A's and the B's? No crossing over. A, B, A, B. All we've done is duplicate what we started with. Nothing new, no new combinations. So what's going to happen at first division? It's just we're going to separate the two of them. Have to make it smaller to make it fit. We're going to get one cell that has the two straights and one cell that has the two wigglies. And now that's first division. If we finish second division, what are we going to get? Well, now we're going to separate the two sister chromatids with the capitals or the two sister chromatids with the wigglies. And so we're going to get two kinds of gametes, either with straights or with wigglies. This is all very boring. Nothing interesting has happened at all. But there is another possibility. There is a possibility that a crossing over event will occur where the cut and rejoin is in between genes alpha and genes beta. What will that do? So suppose we have a crossing over event right here. So that means that we cut the two chromatids involved, and the big A is going to end up connected to the little B, and the little A to the big B. So I've drawn that out over here. Our top chromatid didn't do anything, so it still has big A, big B. Our bottom chromatid didn't do anything, so it still has little A, little B. But because of our exchange now, we have the little A here. We still have big B. Oh. And now we have a little straight portion hooked to our wiggly. So now we have big B, little B. So we have switched the part with the A's on it for one pair of chromatids. This is one crossing over event. We've cut two double-stranded DNAs and switched and rejoined them crosswise. So what will happen this time? So now when we have first division, what's going to end up in each daughter cell? So we're really going to divide the cell this way. So now we have one chromatid has capital AB, and the other chromatid has a wiggly part, so it has little a, big B. And now the reverse down here. We have big A, little b, little a, little b. Okay. Now what's going to happen if we finish second division? Are we going to get two kinds this time? We're actually going to get four different kinds this time. We're going to get four kinds because some gametes are going to get the plain old AB, capital AB straight. Some are going to get the plain little AB. Some are going to get the big A little b and little a big B. So now we're going to get four kinds. I want to be sure to draw them the same way they are in the handout. So they're big AB, little AB, little a, big B, big A, little A. So now we actually have four different kinds. What's the difference? If we didn't have any crossing over at all, then our two products of our four products of meiosis look exactly like what we started with. But if, in fact, we had crossing over, two of them look like the original, but two have a new combination. Now, probably the point of all this is that crossing over allows for you to get new combinations. And that may be its major significance, that because of crossing over, you can get gametes with new combinations of A and B allele. Now, how are we going to keep track of what's going on here? These two types of gametes have the same combination of A's and B's as the original that we started with. But these two here in the middle, these two are different than what we started with. So you call the gametes, or the haploid products of meiosis, which could be spores, you call the haploids parental if they have the original combination. And you call them recombinant if they have a new combination of alleles, not the one that you started with. Now, suppose you have a double heterozygote. Does this tell me what I started with? Is this sufficient? A double heterozygote could be two different things. It could be, maybe I better draw the two homologs straight and wiggly. It could be that the big A, big B are on one homolog and the little a, little b are on the other homolog. But it could also be that big A, little b is on one homolog and little a, big B is on the other. Both of those are double heterozygotes. But I expect different results. If I start with the one on the left, I expect most of the time the big A will stick to the big B and the little a will stick to the little a b. But if I start with the one on the right, I think that most of the time big A will go with little b and little b with big A, little a with big B. So I want to know which one did I start with. Whichever one I started with is the parental combination, and the parental could be either one. If I started with the one on the left, what's the parental combination? It's either big AB or little AB. And recombinant is anything else, namely so. But if I started with the other combination, what's parental? This is parental, what I started with. So if I get big A with little b, that would be a parental. Or little a with big b would be a parental. But a capital AB or a little ab, that would be recombinant. So what's defined as recombinant and what's defined as parental depends on what you started with. So how are you going to distinguish these two? They're both double heterozygotes. Well, one way is just to write them like this. So you write what's on one homolog and what's on the other. But if you're trying to type, this is impossible. It's very hard to write. So it's customary to write this one as big A, little b, slash little a, big b. And you write the other one as big AB, slash little ab. So what you write is what's on one homolog, slash what's on the other homolog. That's a shorthand for writing it on the chromosomes. Now, how do you define linkage? Normally, you don't look at the results of one meiosis. You look at the results of many, many meiosis, and you look at the haploids that result from many, many meiosis. And you look how many of those haploids are parental and how many of them are recombinant. If they're mostly parental, if there are more parental than recombinant, then you say that the genes are linked. If parental products of meiosis exceed recombinants, then genes alpha and beta are linked. On the other hand, if the number of parentals equals the number of recombinants, then they are not linked. Now notice that if A and B are on different chromosomes, actually parental and recombinant doesn't make much sense, but the point is that if genes alpha and beta are in different chromosomes, then you're going to get the two kinds, the four kinds in equal proportions. Whatever you call recombinant and whatever you call parental, you're going to get equal amounts of both of them. But if genes alpha and beta are on the same chromosome, it's going to be different. If they're close together on the same chromosome, one way of looking at it is, if alpha and beta are close together on the same chromosome, which way does meiosis go most of the time? Does meiosis go this way? Or the other way? I forgot to write 1 and 2 on your handout. I used the wrong master copy. So it's not a bad idea to write 1 and 2 because the notes refer to 1 and 2. That genes alpha and beta, so alleles A and B, are close to each other, then what do you expect to happen? Most of the time, no crossover. So most of the time, parental products. If, however, A and B are further apart, then you'll get more meiosis taking the second pathway, and you'll get more recombinants. So that the number of recombinants you get reflects how far apart A and B or alpha and beta are. And we'll talk about the exact numbers of that later, but not now. Now we're just talking about it approximately. Now, I've already mentioned that the biological significance of linkage and crossing over seems to be in the crossing over part, that it allows you to get new combinations. Another possibility may be that the ability of chromosomes to engage in crossing over helps to align homologs so that homologs pair properly at meiosis and they separate properly and you don't get non-disjunction. Now, in the laboratory, the ability to study linkage turns out to be extremely important because from the extent of linkage between A and B, how often they stick together, how often they separate, you can get an estimate of the distance from A to B. You can make genetic maps, and this has turned out to be extraordinarily useful. And I want to talk about an example of how you use linkage to do something useful before we get into the fine points of measuring linkage. And I want to talk about Huntington's disease and how linkage has been used to establish a test for the mutation and to find the gene. Now, I referred to this last time, but I didn't explain about Huntington's disease very much because I thought I had mentioned it before, but I don't think I did. I think I mixed my two classes up. Huntington's disease is dominant, as I think we discussed last time. It's a neurodegenerative disorder, and it doesn't usually hit until adulthood. Now, up until, let's say, 10, 20 years ago, there was no test for whether you were carrying the mutation that would lead to Huntington's or not. Now, what that meant is, if you were a carrier of the condition, you had no idea until you got to be 40 or 50 or whatever. Now, why might you think that you have Huntington's? If neither of your, it's a dominant condition, so if neither of your parents had it, it would never enter your mind. But suppose one of your parents had Huntington's, and one of your parents didn't. This is you. And you want to know, am I going to get Huntington's or not? Now, why is this important? The real question is, well, there are two issues. One is, am I going to get the symptoms when I get older, which I may or may not want to know? And the second question is, am I carrying the allele that causes Huntington's, and should that affect my reproductive decisions? So let's think for a minute. Huntington's is dominant. So that means this person does not have the allele that causes it. This person does. And since the disease is fairly rare, this person is usually a heterozygote. Now, what's the chance this person inherited the allele that causes Huntington's? It's 50% because it doesn't depend on this parent. It only depends on this parent. Did you get the chromosome with the big D or the chromosome with the little d? So this individual is a 50% chance of being big D, little d, and a 50% of not, being perfectly okay. Well, before there was any test, you had only one choice. You could wait around for 40 or 50 years and find out. This doesn't sound very satisfactory. So people wanted very much to find a test for big D so that you could tell at an early age whether you inherited it or not. So you could make intelligent decisions about whether to have children, etc. But nobody knew anything about this gene. To this day, nobody knows why having big D gives you Huntington's. We now know what the protein is that D codes for, but we still don't know why having abnormal protein gives you the disease. At this time, nobody had any idea what protein it coded for. So the question was, how are we going to develop a test? And we did it doing using linkage. Suppose that there's some gene I'll call A, and GA is linked to D. Well, all right, suppose the parent is like this. Suppose the parent with Huntington's is heterozygous for A and heterozygous for D. Well, if the kid gets big A, is the kid likely to get Huntington's? Well, if the kid got big A, which of these chromosomes did the kid get? Got the top one. And if A and D are close together, the chance of crossing over between them is small. And so if you got the big A, you probably got the big D. So this person is likely to get Huntington's. On the other hand, if you got little a, you're probably okay. Now, people actually discovered something almost exactly like this. Now, the difference is that this is not really a gene in the classic sense. This is a section of the DNA which varies from person to person. What we've called before a polymorphic region of the DNA. Now, we said that a region of the DNA can be polymorphic or vary from chromosome to chromosome and person to person in several different ways. One kind of polymorphism is a different number of repeats. That's the basis of the FBI identity test. Another kind of variation is differences in sequence that cause the section to be cut differently by restriction enzymes. In other words, a restriction fragment length polymorphism or an RFLP. We actually talked about an RFLP before. Now, what is found here turns out to be a restriction fragment length polymorphism. That is, there are regions here that vary from person to person so that they are or are not cut by restriction enzymes. And in this region, there are two different sites in the DNA, say here and here. Some people have a sequence such that the restriction enzyme cuts in both places. Other people have it so that neither place is cut by a restriction. The sites are both changed so that neither spot is cut by a restriction enzyme. And some people have this spot is cut by a restriction enzyme, but that one's not. And some people are like this. So there are four versions of this region. And depending on which chromosome you're talking about, the DNA is cut up differently by restriction enzymes to make a different collection of pieces of different lengths. So you can cut both places, neither place, one or the other. Now, these four versions of the DNA could be called alleles. But since this is not a gene, it's customary to call them haplotypes. Meaning versions of the DNA. Because here the genotype and the phenotype are the same because what you're looking at directly is the state of the DNA. So, using restriction enzymes, you can tell whether a person inherited this one, this one, this one, or this one. Now, for historical reasons that probably don't make too much sense, these four haplotypes are known as A, B, C, and D. And we know that the region, which is either A, B, C, or D, is here, and then there's another copy of it here. You're either A, B, C, or D here. Now, how do you use this? Suppose that you have a parent, one parent, let's say this one. This is the normal parent. Has the A haplotype here and the A haplotype on their other chromosome. This person is big D, little d, but has the A haplotype on the chromosome with the big D and the B haplotype on the chromosome with the little d. Now, you know this person is AB because when you cut up their DNA with restriction enzymes, you get a certain pattern of pieces. And you know this person is AA because when you cut up their DNA, you get a certain pattern of pieces. Now, how do we know that the big D is with the A and not the B? That you know from looking at the family tree. So let's suppose you know that. You know that this is what the affected parent is. This is what the normal parent is. Now, the question is, if you get an AB kid or an AA kid, AA would mean like this, two A's, what is the chance of getting Huntington's? So why don't you try and figure that out? We're assuming that these two are very close together. The polymorphic region and the gene that causes Huntington's are close to each other so that you can ignore crossing over. And now the question is, if a kid from this marriage is AB, is the kid going to get Huntington's or not? And if they're AA. And if you're a real whiz, instead, you can try, what if this parent were AB? What difference does it make? So why don't you try? You can stick to the simple one, but
Yeah. You say, you're talking about the haplotype?
I'm talking about the haplotype now. So when I say that this is A and this is B, I mean that the two versions of the DNA here are either this version or this version. Okay. So the question is the AB kid going to get Huntington's? And is the AA kid got to worry about Huntington's, assuming no crossing over? It's very quiet here. All right, let's try it. Let's take a vote. What about the AB kid? How many people think this person will get Huntington's? Okay. Not sure. Okay. Not sure. People are mixed here. So I get the impression that nobody has any idea what I'm talking about. So let's try again. Okay? What we're saying, if the kid is AB, what does that mean? Well, the kid had to get a chromosome with A from this parent. Okay. So which chromosome did the kid get from the affected parent? They got the bottom chromosome. That has little d. So is this kid going to get Huntington's?
No.
No. Whew. But what about the other one? If the kid is AA, well, again, we know what they got from the normal parent. But what did they get from the affected parent? They must have gotten the top chromosome. That carries the allele for Huntington's, and they're likely to get Huntington's. So this test allows you to tell from the state of the region linked to the Huntington's gene which version of the Huntington's gene you actually inherited. And this means you do not have to wait 40 years or 50 years to find out if you inherited the allele for Huntington's. Now the interesting question is, do you want to be tested? It turns out that some people don't. Some people figure I'm going to live my life anyway. I don't care. I probably won't have any children anyway. And just let one know. Or as someone who is at risk of having children with it said, having teenagers is enough of a problem. And he didn't have his kids tested. So, but this system works pretty well, but there is an issue here, and this is the possibility that there will be crossing over in here, which will confound it. Or you have to know from the family tree whether this person has the big A with the big D or the B with the big D. Both of those pieces of information are not always available. So the question is, it would be even better if we could test for the gene itself. If we knew what was the defect in this gene that causes Huntington's, and we could have checked for the gene itself. Now, it turns out people were able to do that. They were able to isolate the gene itself starting from this. How do you usually locate a gene? Usually you know about the protein it makes. You make cDNA from the message, or you make an oligopeptide probe, and then you find the piece of DNA that codes for the gene. That's the usual method. You work from the protein back to the DNA. But here, nobody knew what the protein was. So how are we going to find the gene? Well, the only thing we know about the gene is that we have positional information. And so we have to do what is called positional cloning. Meaning, let's go back to here. We know where the polymorphic AB region is in the chromosome. So where's the gene that causes Huntington's? Now, I ought to draw the chromosome probably more accurately. If we know where the polymorphic region is, where is the region that causes Huntington's? It's either down here or it's over there. But we don't know which. All we know is it's close to our polymorphic region. So using recombinant DNA technology, what you do is you pick out this piece, and then you pick out this piece, and then you pick out the next piece, and you keep going. And then you pick out the piece over here, and the next piece, and the next piece. And what you do is you compare each piece from normal people to people who have Huntington's until you find a section that is always different in people with Huntington's. This is called chromosome walking for reasons that you might understand. You walk down the chromosome, you look at this piece, you look at the next piece, you look at the next piece, you look at the next piece. When you finally, the people found this test relatively early. It took them 10 years to find the gene itself. And the reason for that is that the mutation in Huntington's is quite subtle. It is a repetition of a codon many, many times. Normal people already have this mutation replicated many times. But if the number of repeats is small enough, I think under 30, you don't have any symptoms. If the number of repeats is over 50 or 35 or whatever the number is, you get symptoms. And the more repeats you have, the earlier the onset of the condition. So it took people a long time to realize that the difference between repeats and more repeats was the cause of this disease. But now people have actually located the gene itself. And so you can now test whether someone has inherited the mutant form of the allele with too many repeats or the normal form of the gene with only the normal form of the repeats. But still, not everyone wishes to be tested for reasons that I think are not that hard to understand. Now, I want to come back and just say a few words about the details and analysis of crossing over, and then we'll wrap it up next time. We have said that you look at the products of meiosis and you are able to classify the products of meiosis as either parental or recombinant. From the proportion of recombinants, you can estimate the distance between genes alpha and beta. Now, this is not totally straightforward because of a problem that we haven't faced. We have assumed that when you have one meiosis, one of two things happens. Either you have no crossover in that meiosis, or you have one crossover. However, sometimes you have multiple crossovers in a single meiosis. And when you have multiple crossovers, what does that do to the number of recombinants? You can actually lose some. Because you have a crossing over that switches the A's and the B's, and then another crossover that switches them back. So if you have too many crossovers, it gums up the works. And therefore, the correlation between the number of recombinants and the distance between alpha and beta is only linear up to a point. And what we will discuss next time is why what up to a point means and what the implications of it are. And then we're going to stop talking about crosses with individuals and think about the genotype of a population. And we'll do that for as much time as we have next time. So I apologize for having a lecture on study day, but because of the holidays, we had to do it. So we'll have our next lecture is Tuesday, this room, same time.